like to talk about is where the genes fit into all this, and for, after we get started, relate the genes to cancer and other aspects of involvement here. But before I get into heredity, I'd like to give a little resume of past ideas to get you into the idea of actually what heredity is, see how we have changed our thinking in the past 1,000 years or so. You may think that why bother to talk about heredity, you know, you're stuck with what you've got and what can you do about it. But actually the way things are coming out today, maybe there is something that can be done about it. This is some of the exciting things that are happening today. First up, some of the old ideas. Maybe you've heard of blood inheritance. This is a pretty common one. Some people even talk about it today. You know, maybe you've heard this one about somebody, well, their great-grandmother was a Negro, therefore they've got Negro blood. Then what are the possibilities of them giving birth, you see, to a jet black child? Well, there's no such thing as blood inheritance. In other words, the inheritance is in the genes and the chromosomes, not in the blood. In other words, if my blood is transfused to somebody else, my characteristics will not go to that individual. In other words, I don't have little things in my blood that might be Negro blood or otherwise. There's no such thing as Negro blood or white blood. It's the genes that carry the characteristics. It's not in the blood. Some other ideas. Incidentally, the ancients had ideas about inheritance way back, even before the time of Christ. You see pedigrees on some of these stone things indicating horse breeding. The Chinese did some breeding, trying to improve strains of rice. This is way back before the time of Christ. Then a good deal. Then some ideas came up during the early Greek and Roman times, and then still later on. One of the interesting ideas was hybrids. They got sort of carried away with this and figured that it would be possible to make two different organisms together, you see, and get something sort of in between. So one of these was, they made it a giraffe with a long neck and a sparrow with the feathers and came out with an ostrich, sort of something in between. But so they had some picturesque ideas. One of the interesting ones was the idea of pre-formation that I have up here. And this was even carried out during the time of the early microscopes and the first time that they saw sperm. And their claim was that in their primitive microscopes, which really weren't much better than a magnifying glass, they saw the sperm here. And believe it or not, right inside there, maybe eyes and mouth and all, was the new individual right inside the sperm there. They actually claimed that they could see this. So this is an idea of pre-formation. In other words, the whole individual was in the sperm. Well, then you get the idea that the woman isn't of too much importance. And that was the general opinion, I think, of most of the men of the time. The importance of the woman was just merely a house for this important sperm and the little man inside to grow up. Then, of course, there were a few that argued that it was the egg that was important and not the sperm, these people. So there was a nice little rivalry going on. Where was the individual? Was it in the sperm or was it in the egg? Well, a few little complications there. Supposing if the man is in the sperm, supposing the new baby happens to look like the mother, I don't know how you explain that one away. And they never gave any explanation for that. Another idea was encasement theory. An idea that not only there was one man inside there, but inside that man there's another, you know, inside his sperm, you see, would be another, and then it goes on ad infinitum, you see. So in a way, everything is, there's no possibility of changes, you see. Everything is already preformed. Darwin, you're quite familiar with, for survival of the fit, this idea. However, he had an interesting idea of heredity, which we don't quite agree with today, called pangenesis. In other words, he felt that there were little particles in the body called pangenes. These things were all throughout the body. They weren't like chromosomes or our concept of genes, because they were not located within a certain region. They would be all throughout the body, and these things would influence then the new individual. In other words, you would have pangenes for your fingers, your hands, arms, everything. These would migrate to the sex cells, and during copulation, then these would all come together, both male and female, and then you'd get the new individual. Closing now, one of the parents had his arm chopped off in a meat grinder or something and was missing the right arm. Okay, he wouldn't have any pangenes in this right arm. Next question is, would the child then have the right arm? Well, if supposing the mother has the right arm, I guess there's no problem. Supposing now she just happened to lose her arm too in a similar manner. Now, you can see the fallacy involved here. There are no pangenes, you see, for either right arm, and yet it's my guess that the offspring would have the right arm, you see. So here's another little fallacy. A person by the name of Weissman picked this up and pointed out the fallacy. He experimented with mice. He grew strains of mice, chopped off their tails for 20 generations, saying that if we chop off the tail, there'll be no pangenes for tail. Then the 21st generation, he decided not to chop off the tail, and presumably with absence of pangenes for 20 generations for a tail, certainly the 21st generation can possibly have a tail if pangenesis were valid. And believe it or not, our 21st generation of mouse had a tail, proving that pangenesis, you see, was not the correct answer. He suggested an idea of germplasm, in which, in other words, the characteristics would be in this, in your so-called germplasm, and he described the other portion of the body as somatoplasm. In other words, what happens to your arm or leg cannot influence the your offspring. In other words, this is also brings up another idea presented by Lamarck, and you may think that his ideas are long outdated, but we find that right up to 2 years ago, Lamarckianism was quite vogue in Russia. Lamarck was inheritance of acquired characteristics. In other words, you stretch your neck, it gets longer, and your children have longer necks because you've been stretching your neck. And if you continue it, maybe you'll look like a giraffe pretty soon. In other words, using something makes it develop more in a certain manner, and this is inherited. In other words, what you do to yourself is inherited by your children. Well, we know that our children, in other words, if we want muscles, you have to work at it. Just because I'm strong or my husband's strong does not necessarily mean that the children will be strong unless they work accordingly. In other words, you aren't naturally gifted with these things. In other words, you must utilize particular organs. In other words, his idea of use and misuse. If you don't use an organ, then it would atrophy to an extent, but this would then be transmitted, you see, to your offspring. A person by the name of Lysenko, you may have heard him, in Russia, early 1960s, took over the Russian Genetic Institute. Obviously a promoter of Marxism. Incidentally, Marx wrote his doctrine at the time that Lamarck was in vogue. In other words, the idea then was inheritance of acquired characteristics. Lysenko made elaborate claims stating that they could improve the agriculture, everything, by using this idea of environment acquired characteristics. In other words, these could be inherited then. So by changing the environment then, they could automatically change the inheritance, the heredity. This made a very rapid method of breeding. You see, you don't have to wait for the seeds and crossbreeding and everything. You see, you just change the environment nicely and you get a better breed automatically. Sounded great. They'd be able to improve the grain in 2 years instead of 10 or 20 year project. So, you know, speak with conviction and loud enough, and shout out Mark's name, and this is what happened. Anyone who thought otherwise, who believed in Western genetics, disappeared sort of strangely and was never seen or heard of again. The Russian geneticists then, at this time, denied Western ideas. They did not attend many of our genetical congresses. Those who did were Lysenko geneticists. They denied the presence of DNA, which we'll get into in a bit, which is really where heredity is leading us today. In other words, incidentally, they also made some claims about blood. In other words, that here, actually, that this worked with animals. Lysenko made a lot of elaborate claims, and none of these were actually been duplicated in the Western world. So therefore, to accept a scientific theory proposition, you must be able to repeat it. We could not repeat these. We never got the same miraculous results by blood transfusions and such that you could change individuals. It just didn't work. So we could not accept these. It wasn't until about 2 years ago that Lysenko was removed from the Russian Institute of Genetics. They're trying to catch up now, but this is pretty tricky when you've been, when you're 20 years behind the rest of the world, plus you've removed all the people who dare to speak out against Lysenko genetics. Who've you got left? Lysenko people. All the others are gone. There's no one to teach the new idea. There are no books. There's nothing. And you can imagine what can happen in 6 or 8 short years of preventing the spreading of scientific knowledge. And this is what's happened in Russia. Where are we heading today in genetics? Let me mention the father of genetics I haven't mentioned yet. This is Mendel. I will go into his ideas. Perhaps you've heard of some of them. In other words, the idea. He first gave us the laws of inheritance. In other words, the fact that you get characteristics from both parents, and you get, in other words, one chromosome from one parent, one from the other, and there's the these. What you are depends on what you get from each of the parents, but also he brought out aspect of dominant versus recessive. In other words, supposing one parent has brown eyes, one has blue, what about the offspring? In other words, one of these is frequently dominant over the other. So if you have, in other words, supposing you as an individual had a gene for brown eyes and a gene for blue eyes, you would end up with a brown eyes because brown is dominant over blue. In other words, if you had true blue eyes, you would have two genes for blue eyes. In other words, there are certain characteristics that are dominant over the other, so you would have this particular expression. And then he gave statistical laws for when you would get certain things. So Mendel was really our father of genetics. 1865, he did his work. He was a monk and worked largely with garden pea. His work was not accepted or really read or anything done until 35 years later, 1900, when the rest of the world caught up. Then, from then on, we have proceeded fairly rapidly in genetical thought. Following Mendel, we went and to work on the pea. We've moved into Drosophila, the fruit fly. Here, we found a lot of exceptions, of course, to Mendel's laws. Went into sex inheritance. What happens if some of these genes are linked with the sex chromosome, and then so on, in changing, showing variations of the pattern Mendel. Drosophila used up, well, actually still used today, but I'd say presently perhaps more in vogue are bacteria and virus. Why? Drosophila is very desirable, has 4 chromosomes, and rather than 10 or 12 as we get in P. They're easy. We have mapped these chromosomes, know where on the chromosome are the genes with particular characteristics. One disadvantage of Drosophila is the slight limitation as far as progeny is concerned. In other words, you have to wait 2 weeks or more for a generation. And then, of course, you need little vials for all your little flies, which is, of course, quite an improvement over pea when you have to wait a whole season, you see, for the pea plants. But, so Drosophila was a great improvement over the plants, the pea, but bacteria far superior. Size of bacteria, microscopic. You can grow in a small test tube like this, billions, not one, not 100, billions. And the dividing rate for bacteria is tremendous. Every 20 minutes, you start with one bacteria, in 20 minutes you'll have two, 20 more minutes, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, and so you need 12 hours for perhaps all you'll get. Fortunately, they don't keep on at this rate forever. We would have long been overrun by bacteria, but when the nutrients run out, then this stops. But you can, in other words, you can grow perhaps in a couple of test tubes millions of organisms in the course of 12 hours. 24 hours, whereas instead of having to wait 2-3 weeks for just hundreds. So no, takes no space at all for a test tube, stick it in an incubator, and you can have billions that you can work with. Virus, even smaller yet, these attack the bacteria, so they're only a fraction of the size of the bacteria, grow even faster. In virus, you have one virus attack a bacteria perhaps, particular time. In 20 minutes you have not two virus but 200. So you go from 1 to 200 in 20 minutes, so you can imagine the numbers that you can get with virus. Bacteria are much simpler than the fruit fly. You only have one chromosome rather than four. Virus, even simpler yet, so all you have is DNA, and here's where we get to the real stuff, the DNA, because the best way of studying it is working with virus, because virus is really nothing much more than DNA. It many different shapes for virus. I can give you a typical kind of shape, hexagonal sort of head, a little tail, which it attacks the host, and inside is what we call nucleic acid. This can be either DNA or RNA. We'll specialize on DNA. Remember that either of those could be, not both, one or the other, could be in the virus. But I'll talk now about DNA as the important substance as far as heredity is concerned. This could be a bacteria here. And what happens? The virus attacks the bacteria by its tail and will inject into the bacteria its DNA. This is all that happens. This is a coat on the outside. It's made of protein. It remains on the outside, has no importance as far as what happens next. In other words, the DNA that's injected into the bacteria has all the information necessary for producing not one but 200 more complete virus, all inside the bacteria. So this is one of the evidences we had that DNA is the substance that is important as far as heredity is concerned. We also have other evidences. We have found that it's possible to have bacteria in a solution in which there is DNA. The bacteria will uptake the DNA and become changed. In other words, they will be hereditarily changed. So DNA, again, is this important substance. Okay, why don't we talk about now DNA, what is it? We have talking about it, let's talk about the structure of it. This is a model as proposed by Watson and Crick. You may have heard of these. I'm sure you've heard about DNA, probably read about its structure. Reader's Digest, Atlantic Monthly, most of the popular magazines. I'm sure you read something or other about DNA. This is the hereditary material. You'll find it in the nucleus of the cell. In other words, our cells have a nucleus, and here is the controlling center, and your DNA is in the nucleus. It is the chromosomes, the important carriers of heredity, have this DNA. Okay, your DNA seems to be a double-stranded structure, and it's sort of like a spiral staircase, only there are two of these strands. The other important factor about the DNA, there are four bases. These, I'll write the names, and then we'll use symbols. Adenine, thymine, cytosine, guanine. Okay, we'll use A, T, C, and G to represent these bases. The bases project in towards the center. They sort of act like a lock and key type of mechanism, like such. Supposing this one here is adenine. That means that the one over here must be thymine, can be nothing else. They fit together like a jigsaw puzzle. This one is cytosine, this must be guanine. And this one, let's make it adenine again, this has got to be thymine. So on, all the way down. Okay, the order of these bases is of particular importance, we'll bring about. Okay, what has DNA must be able to do? First, it must be able to explain reproduction. Why is it possible for this cells to divide, mitosis? DNA must be able to explain this, must be able to explain characteristics. In other words, why do you have blue eyes, why do you have brown hair and such. So this DNA then must be able to explain all of these things. First, how can it divide? What happens? It splits down the center like a zipper. You've got two halves, you know. Undo your zipper, you've got two parts. What happens? Each of these creates a half to go with it. All right, supposing we work with this one now. The complementary half, the T, would have to have a what going opposite? An A, nothing else. The G has to have a C, and so you end up with identically what you started with. And then the other side, the A strand, would have to make a T to go with it. C would have to have a G to go with it. A would have to have a T to go with it. So you end up then with two things when you start with one. Undo the zipper, each strand forms the complement, and you have two separate strands. So you have, in a sense, reproduced yourself. You have started with one, you end up with two. And this is how it is possible to explain reproduction. Now the next thing we want to explain is, how can we now, using DNA, explain how this can control all your characters, whether you have arms, legs, hair, color it is, absolutely everything, your metabolism, whether you have diabetes, whether you don't, so on and so forth. This is done by the arrangement. Okay, let me just take a single strand of DNA now, right down the side here, and it is the arrangement of the bases on this that determines all of your characteristics. Why don't we make a little simple one? C-A-T, 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 so on. In other words, this spells out a message, just like the letters you see in a book spell out a message. In other words, you read the letters in words, the words give you concepts, sentences, paragraphs, and so on. You get your message from a book, the body gets its message from the bases here on the DNA. It's just the same as reading a book. Your body reads the information on DNA. How does it do it? Usually the words are in threes. So we've got cat, 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 cat here. This is sort of loaded. Three of these bases equal or will make out one amino acid. Well, what's an amino acid? This is the building block of a protein. And a protein's the important thing. Amino acids make up proteins. We need perhaps maybe 10,000 amino acids to make up one protein. So you can imagine how long the DNA must be. Imagine 30,000 bases to equal one protein. All right, the amino acids then make up the protein. They're the building blocks of the protein. And of what importance is the protein? This is of extreme importance. The proteins determine everything. In other words, coloration perhaps, and any particular characteristic in all metabolic processes. In other words, supposing you have a mistake in one of your proteins, or enzymes might be a better term for it. If you have one mistake, maybe you're missing the enzyme. What happens? Maybe you can't digest then a certain protein or a certain substance that you take in. You can't digest it because you're missing this enzyme. What happens? You get an accumulation and maybe death results. Maybe you just don't make it at all. Or you get some cases, genetic abnormalities. You never develop more than perhaps 6 months, 1 or 2 years. In other words, mentally deficient because of missing just one of these enzymes. In other words, they're essential for all of your life processes. Thousands of enzymes. And these are all written out. The message to make all these enzymes is written in the DNA. So these, you can see now the chromosome is of extreme importance. Next question, suppose there's a little mistake here. Supposing now we lost one of these C's here, just, you know, one of those mistakes, lost it. What happens? That means that, okay, we're going fine here with C-A-T-C-A-T, but now what have we got? A-T and then C is stuck here. That's the wrong thing, isn't it? And then a whole bunch of wrong ones all the rest of the way. Chances are you'll end up then with non-function. You'll be missing the enzyme and that's it. Other possibilities, supposing maybe we just switched some letters. Supposing we had CCC and maybe we got CCOA instead. There are 20 amino acids possibilities, and there are 64 possible combinations fixing around the three letters in a variety of ways. If you want to something to do sometime, you can figure out say all 64 combinations. But there are 64, and which means that it is possible to have an altering of letters, and you might still end up with the right amino acid, and no mistake, you see. So there are ways, you see, that we can have little mistakes, and there's no problem. But fortunately for this, and when you consider we're all here, we've all got our arms and legs, and most of us, I don't need injections of one hormone or one enzyme or another to survive. Think of the amazing, you know, stability of this fact that, you know, how all our, you know, with a relative minimum of errors, mistakes, or otherwise, everything is compensated and we have our enzymes and such. But just to show you what can happen, you see, if there is a mistake, and a mistake or a change in this is what we can use the term mutation. Mutation might be a mistake or a change in the heredity. This is something now that can be passed on, you see, something that's in the heredity itself. What about mutations? What causes these? Environment, for one, could cause a mutation. Particular kind of environment. Here's where we get to smoking again. It's conceivable that the carcinogens in the smoke cause mutations, and this may be a factor involved in cancer. I'll get to this in a minute. Virus can cause mutations or change. X-ray could cause a change. Right? In other words, there are various factors that cause these. Incidentally, we're all exposed to a certain amount of radiation anyway, background radiation. This could cause spontaneous mutations. So there, we can induce mutations, in other words, by X-raying people or otherwise, or you can get them spontaneously. Yes?
LSD.
Yes, right. We have evidence of breakage of chromosomes, too. We can actually observe these. things that occur. Okay, now let's get into where genetics and cancer could possibly fit in. Let me go back to the virus for just a minute. The virus, let's assume a virus is attacking a bacterial cell. Normally it would be about so big in comparison to your bacteria. It injects its DNA. Normally then, what happens if the virus is what we call virulent? In other words, you've got an active virus infection. What happens? Following happens. The DNA here takes over all the information of the bacterial cell. No more operation as far as bacteria. What do we end up with? Just a virus inside the bacteria. Some 200 of them. Bacterial cell breaks open, out comes the virus, 20 minutes, not very long. So you've got all these viruses, now you start with one, you see a virus infection can take over rapidly. Viruses don't always behave this way. There's another kind of virus that we call temperate. It behaves in a different manner. It injects the DNA, same way, but apparently there's some factor involved. The DNA maybe is incomplete, and you don't get any virus inside. The DNA instead attaches to the chromosome of the bacteria and changes it. Maybe you can't observe the change, but nevertheless there is something here. Attaches to it and it is hereditarily transmitted to the offspring. Some cases it's possible to inject, to induce cancer by injecting a certain virus. We find it appears to be a certain kind of virus. We call it a sort of an incomplete virus. It's incapable of producing new virus within the cell. What does it do? Apparently it alters the information of that cell. What happens? That cell is no longer capable of carrying on its normal function. What does it do? Could become cancerous. In other words, what do we mean by cancer in this case? Continually divides. It does not mature or differentiate. It divides, you have two, divides again, you have four, then eight, so on. They don't necessarily have to divide rapidly. You could have 2 weeks, 4 weeks between a division. This is why some cancers are so difficult to catch at first. The dividing cells divide slowly. 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, who'd ever know was 32 cancer cells? Impossible. But wait till you get into the 4,000, and then the next division, 8,000, 16,000, 32,000, 1 million, 2 million, 4 million. You see, after a point, then you've got all these cells, all of them dividing, none maturing, none carrying out their function. Then you see you can get proceeds at a more rapid rate. So this shows how injection of a virus, you see, could conceivably be a cause. I'm not saying the or otherwise, but it can be a cause of cancer, you see, by altering somehow the genetic apparatus of the cell. And conceivably anything that could cause the information of the cell to stop, in other words, to change such that it will no longer mature and will continue to divide. Something's happened there that this occurs. And anything that could do this then, you see, could cause a cancer. X-ray can cause cancer by similar mechanism. And carcinogens, same thing. Probably altering in some way your genetic apparatus.
Perhaps linkage. In terms of the different breeds of cancer, breed 1, 2, 3, and 4, as far as how rapid it is spread and everything, does this have to do with?
I'm not familiar with the grades of cancer. Leo, do you know about this? Grades of cancer?
Yeah, this is a. It's a pretty qualitative thing as far as the grades of cancer, you know. I mean, and it's essentially an indication of their wildness, or you make a prediction. When you take a frozen section, and you know as well as I mean, the pathologist looks at it and he says, this is grade 3 carcinoma stomach, you know, and that's bad, you know. I mean, and he does this a lot on the number of mitosis and the extent of differentiation.
the grade three, is this in terms of what spreads as far as what it is, that it spreads more rapidly?
No. In other words, and if there's a lot of mitosis in there, it's undifferentiated, then this is it's a wild one, you know? And on something like this, especially on a stomach cancer, and a few of the others, this is the ones you just saw back
the
up.
The smaller the number, the more chance for recovery.
If you have very few mitotic figures, it's a slower growing problem.
Yeah.
We usually carry on a few minutes more unless they're real hungry.
Why don't I leave it open to questions? I think I've gotten the major points across the fact that virus, particularly if it's an incomplete one, incidentally, one of the problems of trying to prove that cancer or suggest virus as a cause of cancer is the fact that you can't pick out virus in cancerous tissue. But you see, the reason is that the virus is incomplete, is within the cell, it's not, you see, a regular virus infection. Cancer is not a virus infection like would be some of your, influenza, the common cold and such. These are regular virus infections. Incidentally, you cannot attack cancer then in a way that it might be possible to attack a virus infection, you see, because it's different. The virus has entered the cell, it is within the cell, it isn't just around in the tissue. So in this case, immunization is of no value, and interferon, another substance we're developing for the use of virus infection, is of no value for cancer. Any questions on any of this?